And with that, we will now proceed with United States against Roach. Counsel for the defense.
Chief Judge Efron, may it please the court. The central question in this case is whether a service member's conviction and sentence may be affirmed, even though the appellate court has received no substantive submission on the service member's behalf, and even though that service member's appellate counsel have never even read the record of trial. This court's case law provides a clear answer to that central question. The answer is no, and this case must be remanded to the Air Force Court for a new appeal during which Senior Airman Roach receives the actual assistance of counsel. Here are the facts that give rise to this case. Senior Airman Roach was accused of two offenses. He pled guilty pursuant to a pretrial agreement, and he received a sentence that, as approved, consisted of a bad conduct discharge, confinement for 3 months, and reduction to the pay grade of E1.
Counsel, did the appellate concur in the counsel's decision to not file a timely brief?
No, Your Honor.
He did not?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
Counsel, is that a matter of record in this case, or is that a matter of personal knowledge?
Your Honor, it's a reasonable inference, indeed the only inference from the materials in the case.
So it's an inference from the record, not a matter that's established on the record.
Well, Your Honor, of course, circumstantial evidence can be just as good as direct evidence.
I understand that,
does the record
establish that point, or are you drawing an inference from the circumstances that happened?
Your Honor, I believe the record, I mean, there's no statement from the accused, there's no affidavit from the accused saying, I did not want a brief filed in my case. But here's what is in the record. One, we know that on the 23rd of August, the defense counsel put in, to 23rd of August 2007, the appellate defense counsel put in a submission to the court below that said, here are two potential issues in the case. We know that the appellate defense counsel never indicated any intention not to file a brief in the case. In fact, on the 23rd of August, the appellate defense counsel indicated that the appellate defense counsel was working toward filing a submission in the brief in this case. So this wasn't a case where any counsel ever actually made a decision not to file a submission. And in fact, this is what the record definitively establishes, Your Honor. No appellate defense counsel could have made that decision because no appellate defense counsel ever read the record of trial in this case. This case was affirmed 1 year and 28 days after the case was docketed with the Air Force Court. And in 1 year and 28 days, no appellate defense counsel read the 81-page record in this case. And without reading the record, there can be no tactical decision not to file. Indeed, there was no decision not to file.
So if they had read the record, this is a different case?
If they had read the record, Your Honor, the result would be the same under United States versus May. But some of the reasoning might be different, Your Honor, but the result would have been the same. Because in United States versus May, this court said that a CCA erred by simply deciding the case without the assistance of counsel. So even if the counsel had read the record, this court's case law would still compel reversal because the Air Force Court received no substantive submission on the accused's behalf. And in United States versus May, this court held that it was error for the Navy Marine Corps court to decide a case without any substantive submission.
What options did the CCA have if they were worried about appellate delay other than proceeding without a brief?
Your Honor, the court had a number of options. Included in them would be to have a status conference in the case. It's interesting to note that from the time when the briefing deadline elapsed in this case, which was March 15, 2007, until when the appellate defense counsel submitted a submission to the court on August 23rd, 2007. In those 5 months, nothing happened in this case, Your Honor. The appellate was past his briefing deadline. I'm sorry, the appellate defense counsel were past their briefing deadline. And yet literally nothing happened in this case. So one option that the appellate court has is to call a status conference in the case. Another option that an appellate court has is to either request or direct the assignment of additional counsel in the case. And this court actually addressed a similar issue to your question, Judge Baker, in United States versus Ortiz, and the Supreme Court addressed a similar issue in Evitz versus Lucy. And in both of those cases, the court made clear that what the court should do in a situation like this is take some action against the counsel. but not hold the accused, not hold the appellant or the service member in this instance, not make the burden of the counsel's deficiency rest with that individual.
What action should they take against counsel?
Well, Your Honor, in United States versus Ortiz, this court said, where there's been a flagrant or repeated disregard of our rules, we shall impose appropriate sanctions against the offending counsel. These may include suspension or disbarment from practice before this court. So one option that was available to the lower court, and I would certainly hope that the lower court wouldn't start with this option, but one option would be to have some sort of proceeding regarding the counsel's ability to continue practicing in that court. And if the counsel were no longer allowed to practice before that court, then of course replacement counsel would have to be assigned. And the Supreme Court made a similar point in Evans versus...
Does the record reflect whether counsel's actions were taken with or without the concurrence of the appellate division director?
I don't believe the record reflects that, Your Honor. In Evans versus Lucy, the Supreme Court...
Does the record reflect whether there were any provisions within the appellate division for tracking cases, so that when 162 days passed at that period, the director of the appellate division would have known that counsel had not been granted an extension and something needed to be done?
That is not reflected in the record.
Not reflected in the record.
Again, all we know from the record is that the briefing deadline came and went on March 15, 2007. Nothing was filed. And then the very next thing that we know from the record is that sometime between August 20th and August 23rd, the record of trial was picked up by a reservist counsel who was going to review the record. And then on August 23rd, a motion for enlargement out of time was submitted, requesting permission to file.
And does the record reflect whether there were any systems within the appellate division that would have alerted the director of the appellate division that now a decision has been made by the appellate court to go ahead and to somehow bring that to the attention of the director of the appellate division? Does the record reflect anything about that?
No, Your Honor.
As well, does the record reflect whether any of the current counsel in the case were in the appellate division at the time of the Court of Criminal Appeals decision on August 23rd at the time that the decision was reached in this case?
Due to the lower court's erroneous recitation of counsel in the case, it's apparent that Colonel Hall was in the appellate defense division at that time because the lower court erroneously listed her as counsel.
And does the record reflect whether Colonel Hall was the supervisor of the counsel in this case that the defense counsel now asserts did not even read the record in the case?
Your Honor, I don't believe...
And I'm not asking for any testimony or any personal knowledge. I'm asking what the record is. I'm not asking for that.
I understand that, Your Honor. And I don't believe it does.
That's fine. If you find anything supplemental, I don't mean to delay the proceedings any further if that's your answer now.
In fact, I'm looking now at the original opinion in this case, and it identified Colonel Hall, but it did not identify her by position.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Did you have anything else on the menu of things, options available to the CCA? You did a status call, direct or request additional counsel and sanctions. Anything else you'd like to add to the menu?
Yes, Your Honor. There are at least two other options. And one option would be to, would be to request that a member of the court's bar handle the case pro bono, as appellate courts often do, as the Supreme Court of the United States often does. So one option, if the appellate court perceives that there is a lack of representation, one option the court has is to request a member of the court's bar to handle the case pro bono.
Couldn't the court do that simply by directing the judge advocate general to appoint other counsel in the case?
Yes, Your Honor.
And would it be necessary for the court to formally sanction the counsel who was representing Chairman Roach at that point, or could the court simply say, we're not observing the representation here that's required by Article 70, we're removing this counsel from the case and directing the judge advocate general to appoint somebody else?
Your Honor, that's certainly permissible, and in fact, one of the things
I didn't understand your menu to suggest otherwise, Could you please complete your menu?
Yes, Your Honor. And then at the very far end, and again, keeping in mind both the Supreme Court's case law in Evitz v. Lucy and this Court's case law in Ortiz, that indicates that the sanction should go against the counsel rather than to the service member. At the very far end, if a counsel continually persists in violating the court's directions, it could be the cause for an ethical complaint. So you have a continuum going, you know, beginning at a status conference and ending with professional sanctions against the counsel. But again, all of the remedies should be directed at the individual who actually has the ability to solve the problem, and that is the counsel and not the accused.
Seems like the counsel here is basically telling the CCA that he'll file a brief when he feels like it, when he's ready, and when he's able to. And if CCA doesn't like it, they can grant sentence relief under Marino. You know, so it basically, he's trying to whipsaw the CCA. We hector the CCAs to move cases, and he's trying to whipsaw them by inaction.
Yes, Your Honor, and there were two problems with what happened below in this case, Your Honor.
What I'm saying is that puts CCA in a pretty between a rock and a hard place.
Well, we would say not, Your Honor, because again, the CCA has a number of options available to it that were not taken in this case, and instead, the CCA went directly to a remedy, a procedure remedy, that is expressly prohibited by this court's case law.
Counsel, you started the case by framing the question your way. What if we look at it a little differently and say that, yes, we can all agree that it would be best and that it's required for a counsel to review the record of trial and to make a conscious decision whether to file a brief or to make a merit submission? We can all agree about that. But under Flores-Ortega, you look at all the facts and circumstances to determine what happens next. Is that right? I mean, that's what the case says. It doesn't say that you automatically assume that there's error, that you decide whether you're going to test for prejudice or not. Why don't we test for prejudice here? In this case, where it's a guilty plea, where the lower court looked at the record of trial and reviewed the errors and determined that there was no meritorious submissions that could have been made, and so that he'd not been prejudiced.
Your Honor, this case is not governed by Flores-Ortega. This case is governed by Penson. And indeed, Flores-Ortega cites Penson. And the question of Flores-Ortega was what happens when it's unclear from the record whether an accused desires to appeal the case. What happens in that scenario? And that is not the scenario we have here, Your Honor. It is absolutely clear that the accused desired to appeal his case, and on the day of trial, he actually put in a request for appellate counsel. And on that request for appellate counsel, it expressly said that he desired that appellate counsel to raise any issues on his behalf. And this,
now, I understand that you would like us to read Flores-Ortega for that very limited proposition, counsel, but don't you think that it also is talking about the question is, did an appellant have counsel or did they have no counsel? And so that's really the question for us to decide. Did this person have no counsel simply because he didn't read the record of trial before the decision was made by the CCA? Or did he have assistance of counsel, but not as much assistance of counsel as he should have had? Because it seems to me that that's the issue that determines whether we test for prejudice or not.
Your Honor, in Flores-Ortega, the Supreme Court expressly said, we have long held that a lawyer who disregards specific instructions from the defendant to file a notice of appeal acts in a manner that is professionally unreasonable. And what we have in this case, Your Honor, we have an actual request from the accused on the day of trial through appellate defense counsel that actually requests that the appellate defense counsel advance any issues on his behalf. And in fact, that may actually be an answer to your initial question, Chief Justice.
Counsel, how much viability cases like Penson, which of course arise in the civilian milieu, have here when you've got the unique Article 66 powers of the CCA that where it is statutorily required to review the whole record apart from submissions by counsel, statutorily required to review the whole record and determine that it is correct in law and in fact, That's not applicable to a case like Pinson, and I question the how much of Pinson you can read into a case where you got an Article 66 court doing this kind of review, and there's no question, presumably here, that this Article 66, that this court did its review under Article 66 in a proper manner, leaving aside the question at bar here.
Your Honor, the May directly addressed that issue and directly decided that Article 66 did not negate the need for appellate counsel. It expressly addressed that. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I see my time has expired. May I please finish?
You may complete your answer, and if any other of my colleagues have questions, we'll continue until the questions are completed.
Thank you, Your Honor. In United States versus May, this court specifically cited Pinson, relied on Pinson, and relied on Pinson despite the existence of Article 66C. And remember what happened in May.
May was pre-Moreno, was it not?
Oh, yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
But Your Honor, there's nothing in Moreno that conflicts. There's nothing in Moreno that limits May in any way. And in fact, in Moreno, this court wrote, an appeal that is inordinately delayed is as much a meaningless ritual as an appeal that is adjudicated without the benefit of effective counsel. So not only is Moreno not inconsistent with May in any way, they both have the common goal of protecting a service member on appeal for a violation of the appellant's rights. And you cannot protect an accused due process right to timely review at the expense of the accused right to effective assistance of counsel. In May, this court expressly applied Pinson in a situation that is indistinguishable from this case, Your Honor, and expressly rejected the notion that was advanced by the court below that Article 66 review is enough. And in fact, what the court below did is an example of why 66 review isn't enough, because surely if Senior Ehrman Roach had been represented by counsel, had actually received actual representation, that counsel would have said to the Air Force Court, stop, you can't do what you're suggesting under May. And the fact that the Air Force Court never found
to follow up on Judge Ryan, is Article 66 review nonetheless sufficient to obviate prejudice?
No, Your Honor. No, Your Honor. And May expressly says that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, assuming that this court might take a different position, where is the prejudice in this case?
Your Honor, there is actual prejudice in this case. One of the things that that this court pointed to in May as establishing prejudice is that Sergeant Major May's rights under Grostefan were not realized. We know that the accused in this case, Senior Ehrman Roach, has a Grostefan issue. In fact, he filed a motion at this court twice to raise his Grostefan issue. The lower court never considered his Grostefan issue. And we also know from the supplement to the petition for grant of review in this case that had he been represented by counsel, there would have been other issues raised. And one of the issues that certainly would have been raised, Your Honor, is sentence appropriateness. And this goes to one of the issues about why can't we
resolve that here? In Pinson, in footnote 9, the Supreme Court said it's not going to be appropriate for us to get involved in matters of Ohio law at this time, recognizing that there would be unique factual circumstances there. I haven't seen anything in the brief or the supplement to the petition filed in this case that would point to a unique power of the Court of Criminal Appeals that's at issue in this case that our court couldn't resolve as an issue of law in this case right now.
There is, Your Honor. And
what is that?
It's sentence appropriateness.
Well, as I read the petition supplement on sentence appropriateness, it doesn't raise any facts or circumstances with respect to sentence appropriateness. So why can't we resolve this based on the supplement that was filed?
Well, first, Your Honor, as the Supreme Court, and I'm sorry to cite a case that's outside the record, but I'll be happy to file a 36A letter. In one of the Supreme Court's cases where it considered the issue of whether Chief Judge Bound had been correctly appointed to the Coast Guard Court, the Supreme Court said, the Solicitor General had advanced the argument, look, it doesn't matter whether the CCA properly reviewed this case because CAF reviewed it. And the Supreme Court said no, because the CCA has powers beyond those of CAF. So Senior Ehrman Roach was entitled under Article 70 to be represented by counsel when the Court of Criminal Appeals decided
That's not the question. The question is, assuming that there was error in his not having counsel, where is the prejudice? I recognize you're not conceding prejudice, but the questions from the bench have suggested that prejudice may be at issue in this case.
Yes, Your Honor.
And where in the filings before this court has the defense identified specific facts and circumstances that would have entitled your client to relief before the Court of Criminal Appeals on sentence appropriateness? All it says is they didn't discuss Lacey.
Well, Your Honor, there is in fact such evidence, and the evidence comes from Airman First Class Neff's case. Had appellant been represented by counsel below, counsel no doubt would have argued sentence appropriateness. And one of the reasons for that was the companion case of Airman First Class Neff did not result in a punitive discharge.
But counsel, so, would you at least concede that sentence appropriateness is not exactly, you know, a sure winner? I mean, it's rarely granted. It's rarely permitted. It's a very high standard. And the fact that one person got a different sentence than another is not enough.
Your Honor, it may not be enough. This Court has said that it may be. This Court has said that a lower court, that the courts of criminal appeals are allowed to consider other service member sentences even if they don't meet the very limited context of highly disparate companion cases where the lower court must do a sentence comparison.
Well, and to follow up on Chief Judge Efron's question, why can't this court look at that? And if you say it's because the CCA hasn't looked at it, I'll tell you, we know this to be true, that we look at issues for the first time here all the time. And I'll be happy to quit doing that if you'd like to advance that position, but I don't think you do.
Senior Airman Roach would be happy to advance that position, Your Honor. But,
yes.
But there's a two-part response to that, Your Honor. And the first part is that the lower court is the only court in this system with Article 66C powers, and it goes back to the Supreme Court's position in the Coast Guard case. The lower court has powers that this court doesn't have. But the second issue, and this goes back to Judge Stuckey's question, the second problem is a reasonable counsel in this case would have brought in facts from outside the record on the sentence appropriateness issue that the lower court did not have access to. And that is, after Airman Neff received his sentence in his case, Your Honor, the convening authority granted further relief. And I apologize to the court. This was in a submission that I offered. I realize the court denied the motion to submit Airman Neff's court-martial order. So I'm actually referring to a fact that is in a document that this court denied, but I believe this court's questions implicate that document, Your Honor, so I do apologize to the court. But there was this fact from outside the record that a reasonable appellate defense counsel would have put before the lower court to establish the sentence disparity was even greater than it appeared to the lower court. And the lower court had no access to that information, and it once again shows why 66C review isn't enough. Because a lawyer talks to the client, a lawyer develops issues, a lawyer can get facts from outside the record that might touch on these facts. A CCA can't do any of those things, Your Honor. A CCA can't vindicate the accused's right to cross-defend. The CCA cannot and did not go out to Senior Airman Roach and say, hey, Airman Roach, do you have any issues you want raised in this case? As this court held in May, it isn't good enough that a court review a case, and interestingly, in Penson versus Ohio, the Ohio Court of Appeals reviewed Penson's case and actually granted him relief. The Supreme Court said that's not good enough. And in United States versus May, this court...
To be clear, you've had the opportunity to do that, have you not? Is the appellate?
Oh, yes, Your Honor.
And the issue you're bringing before the court is what? Having now had the opportunity to do that...
Yes, Your Honor.
And the issue you're bringing before the court now is the sentence appropriateness issue?
That's one issue, Your Honor. In fact, the supplement raised a number of issues that were denied by this court, that if this case were to be remanded to the lower court, the other issues that were included in the supplement, of course, would be raised.
But you're not arguing that the appellant has not had the chance to raise his issues at the appellate level, at this level?
Your Honor, the accused has never had the opportunity to raise a sentence appropriateness issue in front of the only court that has that power.
I understand that argument. I'm just making sure that there's not a delta between what you're arguing here and what you're arguing there.
Your Honor, the delta is in the respective authority.
Yes, fact-finding authority. Okay.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll give the government 29 minutes now. That does not mean that you need to take all of 29 minutes. You may proceed as you wish.
May it please the court. Good morning. I'm Colonel Roger Bruce, and Major Ward and I have the privilege of representing the Air Force in this case. I'd like to speak a little bit out of order just because the point was recently brought up. And although it's not in the joint appendix, I would draw the court's attention that Airman Roach himself, in his clemency submission, which is part of the record of trial, told the convening authority exactly what sentence Airman Neff, in fact, received. So I just wanted to bring that to the court's attention, that it was a matter at least contained in the record of trial. Proceeding to my argument, if I may, the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals properly applied Article 66, its own court rules, and this court's precedents in affirming the conviction.
Just to follow up on your first point, then, that is a matter that this court, in your view, can take into account in assessing if we decide that prejudice is the proper standard and assessing prejudice with respect to the issue of sentence appropriateness as to whether representation by counsel was necessary at the Court of Criminal Appeals or whether this court can solve that matter here. The question is, can we take a look at that submission to the convening authority in determining the issue of prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you agree with the appellant's counsel that there were other options available to the CCA here?
Yes, Your Honor, I would.
Do you agree with his menu of options? Are there additional ones?
They seemed appropriate. I think the Air Force Court perhaps also could have ordered the appellate defense counsel to show cause as to a couple of things, to demonstrate why he could not produce a brief by a particular date designated by the court, to show cause to the appellate defense division to show why they could not assign additional counsel at an earlier point. I think that would have been within the purview of the Air Force Court, Your Honor.
I mean, you don't disagree that the appellant's counsel in this case should have at least read the record of trial, do you? You don't disagree with that proposition?
No, Your Honor. I do not disagree with that. I think the analysis, though, needs to go deeper than that. I don't think it, because the transcript was not read, that's the end of the inquiry, but I certainly admit that that should have been done. Yes, Your Honor.
Do you agree with the way that I framed the question, that the issue that we really need to decide is whether the fact that he didn't read the record of trial alone means that appellant was deprived of assistance of counsel at all, that he had no assistance of counsel?
I do, Your Honor. I do. The appellant should not be entitled to a presumption of prejudice. This court should test for actual prejudice under the facts of this case. Perhaps, though, the more important question, as the court has alluded to in its questions, is what a CCA can do when faced with an appellate defense counsel, and I'll say an appellate defense division, that isn't doing enough to timely represent one of their clients under the Moreno case. With your permission, I'd like to focus on Moreno with some IAC facts and then more directly address the IAC question itself. The Air Force Court should be supported in its efforts to manage its docket, exercise institutional vigilance, and protect appellants' due process rights. This is an important question for this court, we submit. What a CCA should do when confronted with counsel that's not responding to the requirement for timely appellate processing, when counsel appears to be engaging in some appellate posturing, perhaps strategic delay, and quite frankly ignoring the court's orders. That, we think, is the bigger question. And the CCAs need teeth and tools to enforce this Moreno mandate, as well as protect the other due process rights of the appellant, namely the right to effective assistance of counsel.
Counsel, in that regard, the Moreno has been referred to a number of times, but my question is, does Moreno have anything to do with this case? That is, we have before us a record of counsel not filing at various times, then filing a request for relief when apparently the counsel hasn't even read the record, and then not responding to the court's order when the court said it's going to go ahead and decide the case without the brief anyway. If Moreno had never existed, irrespective of the concept of due process and appellate delay, wouldn't we have the same situation that we have now, and that is we have a court that is attempting to decide a case and counsel that's not participating?
Well, Your Honor, there are competing due process considerations here. There is the a due process consideration of the timely appellate review on the one hand, and there's the due process consideration of ensuring that this appellant had effective assistance of counsel. The CCA has a duty to ensure both are met.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's...
And did they push on both, or did they choose one over the other?
Your Honor, I think they did a very good job of trying to achieve both in this case. When faced with counsel that's engaging in this posturing and this strategic delay and ignoring its orders...
The strategic delay and the posturing is the inference that you're drawing from the record. We don't have independent evidence that it was strategic delay or posturing. That's just your...
It's my inference, Your Honor, but I would point to the third and fourth enlargements submitted by counsel in which he essentially said to the court, if you think my delay is going to cause an unreasonable delay, then just go ahead and grant us relief under Moreno. And he listed this court's specific remedy paragraph under Moreno. In our view, he didn't have a good faith basis to suggest Moreno relief was appropriate at that point. Yet here he was trying to assert a remedy on behalf of the client, and that's where our posturing comes into play.
How about ineffective assistance of counsel right then? If we have a situation in which appellate counsel hasn't read the record, and they are now asking for a specific form of relief, under what theory of effective assistance of counsel can that be done?
Your Honor,
I know you're in a tough position as the government arguing this point, but
yes, Your Honor.
At least this judge is trying to figure out what posture that puts everyone in at that point when counsel hasn't even read the record and now they're asking for relief that would be less than the relief that the client might otherwise be entitled to if the record was read.
Yes, Your Honor. It is a fine line that I have to walk here, undoubtedly. But in our view, this court should look to Adams, a 2004 case, because what this counsel did was sufficiently similar to the Adams case, sufficient enough that this court now should test for prejudice, as opposed to May, where prejudice is presumed, as opposed to Penson, where prejudice is presumed.
But in Adams, didn't the defense counsel read the record and make a submission to the court based on that record, make a merit submission?
Yes, Your Honor, that is true. But we think that's only one fact. Reading the record alone, we don't think is case dispositive. And I would point to both Pinson and May for that proposition. In Pinson, the Civilian Defense Council actually read the record, determined there were no meritorious issues, and refused to provide a brief. He withdrew from the case. And that's where the presumption of prejudice kicked in, because counsel was absent at that point when an intermediate appellate court later determined there were in fact arguable errors, reversible errors that it identified, but there was no counsel present.
In what way was counsel present here at the time the CCA made the decision?
Much like the Adams case, if I can just...
What's the record reflect they were actually doing?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. I'll focus on that. And I'd like to draw parallels to Adams because I think it's sufficiently similar. I cannot say it's exactly the same, but neither May nor Adams is exactly on point, but we think Adams is closer,
and counsel,
close enough to go to an actual prejudice requirement. Yes, Your Honor.
And Adams was not a guilty plea case, was it?
I don't believe so, ma'am. I might need to...
The reason I'm asking is that my reading of Flores-Rivera is that one of the factors that the Supreme Court has said should be taken into consideration is whether it's a guilty plea case when looking at all the factors to determine whether you test for prejudice or not.
Absolutely so. Absolutely, Your Honor. In Adams, Civilian Defense Counsel's brief was never filed with the CCA, and Military Defense Counsel filed a merits brief and a gross defense submission footnote in that merits.
Now, mostly, my question was, how was counsel representing this client in this case at the time the CCA made the decision?
Yes, Your Honor.
What does the record reflect he actually did?
Yes, Your Honor. The record reflects that, like Adams, Military Defense Counsel, Appellate Defense Counsel in this case, specifically raised two, I'll call them gross defend-like issues to the Air Force Court. And in fact, those issues were identified in the Air Force Court opinion. The Air Force Court decided that one was worthy of comment. That was the trial counsel qualification issue.
Now, how defense counsel did that? How?
In the let me make sure I get the enlargement correct. I believe it was in the fifth enlargement. Yes, Your Honor. The fifth enlargement filed by counsel contained two gross Defon-like submissions where he specifically said that the appellant believes that trial counsel may not have been qualified to serve and that there may have been some post-trial ineffective assistance of counsel. And the Air Force Court cited both of those issues raised by the appellant through the appellant defense counsel in their opinion. They found only one of them worthy of analysis and comment, but nonetheless, they specifically put them in their opinion, so it's our position that they...
That's useful. Do your menu if you would, though.
Oh, yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. So we believe there was a gross Defon issue presented in this case. We believe that under the Air Force Court Rules 15.4, as the court specifically stated under their rules, they treated counsel's lack of filing a substantive brief as submitting the case to it on its merits.
Could
so you're arguing that in that case, silence in light of the rules was in fact an affirmative action?
As specifically provided by the rule,
15.4. Active representation rather than lack of representation.
That is correct.
How can that be a tactical decision if they haven't read the record?
Well, Your Honor, we take exception to the notion that he did not read the record, because it's clear from the enlargement pleadings filed by counsel that he read significant portions of the record. He described the charges, the location of the trial, the lack of motions, the current confinement
status. I think you said to Judge Ryan that you agreed that they, with the statement that the record hadn't been read. You got a pick.
I do, but I'd like to clarify that.
I think my statement was that you agreed that an appellate counsel should read the record file.
That is correct. That is a good proposition. Yes, Your Honor. In this case, he did not, as stated in his affidavit, read the transcript, but he read significant portions of the record of trial, and that's well reflected in his four-page enlargements, full of details that he would have had to have read significant portions of the record.
That's a third piece of your actual representation.
That's correct. That's correct, Your Honor.
Counsel, Judge Baker, did that answer your question, sir? Is it necessary for us to rely on the rule that you referenced from the Court of Criminal Appeals here? And in asking that, I wonder whether that rule really advances us in any of these areas. That is, if counsel has not made a filing of a brief, and all of the subsequent submissions would show that counsel was simply asleep at the wheel and ineffective, where does that rule get us? And so my question is, do you need to rely on the rule? And if you don't need to rely on the rule, how would you argue this case?
Well, Your Honor, I think there's an argument that it's appropriate to rely on the rule under the facts of this case because it was a judge-alone guilty plea with two specifications. It was a trial that lasted a mere 3 hours. It was a trial in which no motions were filed, no objections were raised. It was a trial in which trial defense counsel submitted an effective clemency package, one that actually resulted in clemency because forfeitures of pay were in fact waived by the convening authority. It was a trial with a pretrial agreement in which the appellant enjoyed the benefit of that bargain when his confinement was reduced from 4 months to 3 months. So under the facts of this case, we think the Air Force Court's reliance on Rule 15.4 was in fact appropriate.
Is that necessary for you to prevail in the case?
No, Your Honor.
Let's assume we're in a situation where Rule 15.4 doesn't exist.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the counsel has not made a submission.
Yes, Your Honor.
And now the question appears to be, how do we deal with a record in which there are indications in which counsel has not read at least substantial portions of the record, has not responded to the court's orders for filing briefs, and apparently there's no record of any supervisory activity at all in the case over counsel. How do we deal with it under those circumstances?
Well, Your Honor, there are additional factors under Adams that we think are present here. In Adams, the Civilian Defense Counsel never filed an appearance, but he was represented by military counsel at all times. The same applies in this case. This appellant, at various points, had six military appellate defense counsel covering the entire appellate process. Now, granted, most of them were the original two Military Appellate Defense Counsel. But nonetheless, as in Adams, he was represented throughout the entire process. Also, in Adams, the court noted that Adams' counsel filed 3 enlargements. We had 5 filed in this case. Any one of these facts alone aren't enough, but we think that when you take all of them together, it gets us to where we need to go to show there was, in fact, no prejudice. Likewise, in Adams.
I don't think that it gets you to show that there's no prejudice. I think it gets you to the issue of whether we test for prejudice.
Yes, Your Honor. I misspoke. That's correct. Whether there should be a presumption or not. You're right.
Now, in any of those enlargements, did counsel assert that they could not comply, that they needed assistance? Did they request assistance from the court other than an enlargement?
No, Your Honor. In the 3rd enlargement, counsel submitted to the court that he had 20 cases that he was working on besides this one.
Did he say in there that, and therefore it is impossible for me to do my job?
No, Your Honor, he did not.
Can't do the job within either normal or extra working hours?
And he did not, Your Honor. In fact, less than 1 month later, he then asserted in the 4th enlargement that his caseload was now down to 10, and finally it was down to 4, but there was never an assertion that he needed more help.
And this question, again, is only to the record or matters on which we can take judicial notice. Is there anything in the record on which we can take notice which would provide us with a basis for concluding that either this counsel or the Air Force Appellate Division was incapable of complying with the orders of the court?
No, Your Honor, I don't think there's anything in the record to suggest they were incapable. I would point to the fact, again, that from the record, there are 6 different counsel that worked on this case. And those 6 all worked in perhaps the most critical time, the August and September 2007 timeframe, which led up to the ultimate decision by the court on Thursday.
Is there any document that we could take judicial notice of in which the Air Force Appellate Defense Division said that it was not properly staffed to perform the functions to which it was assigned?
No, Your Honor, there is nothing in this record to support that notion.
Thank you.
I have a question that's slightly off-kilter from the argument that you're making, but let's say that we agree with you that the lower court's opinion can be affirmed. How does that opinion get written without signaling to the lower courts that they can decide cases on whatever timeline they choose without receiving brief submissions?
Well, Your Honor, I guess it would have to be...
Do you understand my question?
I believe that I do. I think the focus would have to be on the facts of this case. If this case was different, if it was a contested case, if there were court members, if there were motions and objections, I think that should be a clear signal that the result may have been different. But those facts are not present. So as much as I would like a single rule that was going to cover all cases, I don't know that I can advocate for that. Given the record we have before us. One more point on Adams, if I may, Your Honor. Another key fact in Adams was that his final military appellate defense counsel actually communicated with the appellant. A key fact in Adams that is also true in this case, because the record reflects that counsel did in fact communicate with appellant Roach, got his consent for the 5th enlargement that he filed, and got those 2 gross Stefan-like issues. So there was, in fact, actual communication from attorney to client going on in the record. And as I noted, counsel filed those gross Stefan-like issues with the court, which also happened in the Adams case. We acknowledge that the weakest similarity between the facts of this case and Adams was you had an averment in Adams where counsel did state they read the entire record, and we don't have that here. But we again contend that he read enough of the record that he was not wholly absent, which was really the focus in absent.
But that's purely speculation on your part. You don't know whether he read any of the record, some of it, all of it.
Your Honor, I don't see how he could have filed enlargements 3, 4, and 5 without reading a significant portion of the record of trial. If I may turn to that. It's actually quite detailed. I don't see how he could have submitted that. It was required by the Air Force court rules, but if I may briefly, I do believe it's a significant point. It's a 4-page, there are 4-page pleadings. And in those pleadings, he clearly suggests that he reviewed at least significant portions of the record, because as required by the court rules, he noted that the record contained an 81-page transcript, 4 prosecution exhibits, 9 defense exhibits, 4 appellate exhibits. He also described the case in considerable detail, to include the detailed charges and specifications, the findings, the sentence, the form, the site of the trial, the pleas, the current status of the accused confinement. You're not going to find that in an index anywhere. And a description of, or rather the notation of a lack of motions. He also, as I said, went on to ask for Moreno relief. But we think it's enough of a demonstration in the record that he, in fact, read a significant portion. He certainly didn't read the transcript. That's clear from his affidavit. But it's not a case where he read nothing.
Does it turn on that?
Well, by itself, no, Your Honor. But we think all these factors taken together get us to the point where this court should be testing for prejudice. And that's the ultimate point that I'm driving at.
Because you think there was error?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You want to test for prejudice because you're assuming error?
I suggest we should test for prejudice because the law allows us to move directly to.
So you move back from prong 2?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You're moving back from Strickland 2 then?
I think if
there's a lot of focus on prejudice, and if there's prejudice, there's something that's gone wrong. If you're testing for prejudice, I'm not.
Well, if the law allows us to resolve a case by testing for prejudice, I think this is an appropriate case to do so, because I can't sit before the court and fully condone or defend the actions of the appellate defense counsel. I cannot do that, because again, I suggest there's some posturing and strategy going along that wasn't in comport with the Moreno case. But I think perhaps that's why testing for prejudice is the right way to go, especially under the facts of this guilty plea case, Your Honor.
Well, putting aside Moreno, would it be effective assistance for counsel to not have read the record for the time period in which this case proceeded and filing the Moreno request for relief that was filed without having read the record? Would that be a reason to go directly to prong 2 in this case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Would that be a reason to go directly to prong 2 in this case and look just at prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Under the Air Force CCA rules, I think that if a gross defund motion is raised, that the government is required to respond to that.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And in this case, they didn't respond to what you are now categorizing as a gross defund submission. What are we to make of that?
Your Honor, I would suggest that, with respect, that's form over substance. The fact is, this client wanted these issues brought to the court's attention, and they were. And there certainly wouldn't be any prejudice to the appellant if the government was deprived or failed to reply to those gross defund issues. So I think, ultimately, the intent of gross defund was met because counsel put them to the court, and the court acknowledged that they got them and even directly analyzed one of them, found it worthy of comment.
But there is some inconsistency there, that at that point the Air Force didn't feel that it was a gross defund motion, and at this point government is arguing that it was, or it was the equivalent of one.
In light of the history of the case, Your Honor, I feel compelled to present it to the court this way. I don't know that I can describe it in any other manner.
I had thought that your point with respect to that submission was not that it was, in fact, the equivalent of a gross defund submission, but that it was treated like one and that it was evidence that there was assistance of counsel, whether effective or not.
Indeed, again, to get us to the point of whether we can test for prejudice, that is correct, Your Honor. I'd like to make a point about the reconsideration, or the lack thereof, if I may, briefly, because I think it shows a further Moreno problem, if you will. We certainly aren't here to suggest that the appellant and his new counsel were required to file a motion for reconsideration for the Air Force Court. But once again, when we consider the appellant's due process right to a timely appeal, we have to question why they did not do so, whether before this court today, asking you to send the case back to the Air Force Court, when 8 months ago they could have asked the same questions of the Air Force Court. And there's simply no reason or logic to suspect or suggest that the Air Force Court would have refused, under a reconsideration request, to answer those very questions. So here we are 8 months later, and then add the time in that this court needs to issue its opinion. We're probably looking at an additional year of appellate processing time that was violated, in our view, for no good reason. Once again, we don't think that the Moreno aspect of this case has been properly handled by appellate defense counsel, and quite frankly, by the division. We think they could have done more, they could have done more sooner, and they didn't. And that's the tension that the Air Force Court faced, because they really were in a bit of a box.
With respect to the division, does the record demonstrate, or is there a matter upon which we could take judicial notice as to which, if any, of the counsel now representing Airman Roach were in the appellate division at the time this case was under consideration by the Court of Criminal Appeals?
I'm not sure if I quite followed your question, but from the
at the time that this case was under consideration by the Court of Criminal Appeals,
yes,
can we determine whether any of Airman Roach's current counsel were in the appellate division at that time, either from the record or from a document upon which we can take judicial notice?
Your Honor, the closest I can come to the record itself is the fact that 5 days after the Air Force Court issued its opinion, new appellate counsel submitted what I will call a substantive pleading before this court with substantive legal issues that would have required them to read the record of trial. I can't point to anything more in the record than that. That 5 days after the decision, we had a substantive.
No, I'm not asking whether they were involved in this case. I'm asking whether they were in the division, whether any of his current counsel were in the division at the time, and then whether any of them had supervisory authority over the counsel that were there. Is there anything that we can look at either in this record or in a matter which we could take judicial notice?
I'm not aware of a document.
Thank you.
I guess the final comment I have, Your Honors, is the Air Force Court was in a box, and counsel attempted to take advantage of that. Counsel knew that Article 66 required the court to review the case under Article 66. Counsel also knew that the court was under an obligation under Moreno, and counsel repeatedly ignored the court's orders, engaged in delay that didn't seem justified under the record. And the Air Force Court, I believe, did an appropriate job in protecting both due process rights of this appellant. For these reasons, Your Honor, we believe that this court should support the Air Force Court's decision and affirm the conviction and the sentence. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Can I ask a question before you begin your rebuttal? I asked the government's counsel on a question while understanding that you know you're not conceding that we test for prejudice. If we were to determine that was going to be the case, how would this case be dealt with or written in a way that did not signal that in every instance the CCAs could decide cases without briefs if enough time had elapsed?
I think that would necessarily be the message that would be sent from such a case, Your Honor, if it wasn't tested for prejudice, because it's difficult to imagine a starker example of constructive denial of counsel than occurred in this case, where we know that no counsel for the accused ever read the record of trial. So if it's okay here, it's impossible to imagine a case which it would not be okay, and then we'd be moving from a scenario like that in May, where presumption is presumed, to a scenario where it's always tested for prejudice, and that would be a reversal of this court's decision in May. Regardless of whether this court chooses to reverse its decision in May, the lower court definitely erred by not following May. The lower court was required under the principle of vertical stare decisis to abide by this court's decision in May, and the lower court, it violated that duty.
Now, to start where opposing counsel pointed to the fact that the accused's unsworn statement
includes a statement about Neff's punishment.
Does this case turn on May? Can we test for actual prejudice only by overruling May?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel for the other side argued that this is distinguished on the count that there are a number of factors that reflect actual representation. Are you planning to rebut each of those?
Oh, yes, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. In May, counsel were represented by a civilian counsel, George Krippner, and a series of Navy and Marine Corps counsel. So he had actual representation by counsel. Those counsel filed a total of 10 enlargements, motions for enlargement of time.
But I'm more interested in this case.
Well, yes, Your Honor, but that's the point. This case and May are on all fours, Your Honor. In both cases, the individual had assigned counsel. In both cases, there's assigned counsel involved in enlargement practice. And in neither case did that assigned counsel file a brief merit submission or gross defense submission.
Why don't respond to the government's arguments? For example, the government argued that in some manner, either implicitly or expressly, counsel raised two gross defense issues.
It's simply not true. I'm sorry, Frank. It's simply not true. Appellant, in the course of an enlargement motion, noted two issues that the accused that might be raised in the case. That is not the same as a gross defense submission, Your Honor. And in fact, gross defense was a case all about how Anders intersects with the military justices.
I understand now what's your response. Just go down their list. What's your response to the government's argument that in light of the rule, the CCA rule, silence is in fact an affirmative act of representation? What's your response to that?
That's not what the rule says, Your Honor. Rule 15.4 says merits cases. Cases in which appellate defense counsel do not assign and the court does not specify any issue will be designated merits cases. Appellate government counsel need not respond to a case submitted on its merits.
Could the CCA promulgate a prospective rule stating that if no substantive brief is filed within X days, it will be treated as a merits submission?
At best, yes, Your Honor. At best, the CCA's decision in this case was a new rule. At best. Now, we say it's a new rule that would inherently, going back to Judge Ryan's question, it's a new rule that would inherently violate this court's opinion in May, which it may not do, but it was a new rule. That is not how the court interpreted
it. I know that isn't this case. I'm asking, could they promulgate such a prospective rule?
And they could not, Your Honor. But the point is well taken. And I realize Judge's questions are not points, Your Honor. The point bears making that Rule 15.4 does not say what the lower court said it says. Rule 15.4 does not say if you don't file anything, it's a merits.
I understand your contention.
I'm sorry. What was your response ultimately to whether they could?
They cannot.
Okay,
because that would violate.
I thought you said they could.
I heard both answers.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you for the clarification, Your Honor. If the court adopted a rule today saying what the lower court said Rule 15.4 says, it would violate May, Your Honor. It would violate May. Because May expressly says that a CCA may not decide a case without a substantive submission for the accused. So any such rule would violate May, and the lower court may not violate May.
But how is an ordinary submission that's just a merit submission saying we submit the case on the merits? How is that a substantive submission?
Your Honor, it reflects the fact that the accused has reviewed the record and submitted the case. That counsel has reviewed the record and submitted the case without a specific assignment of error. It is a statement on the case's merits, and it's part of the. It provides the representation to which the accused is entitled under the Constitution and Article 70. So if I could now go to the first issue that I wanted to raise, which is, and I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm out of time. May I just quickly respond to the one point of the government?
You may respond to that point, and I'll see if my colleagues have any further questions. And then I believe there's been ample time for the argument, but you may briefly conclude after that.
Thank you, Your Honor. I did want to respond to the first point that opposing counsel made, and that is the record of trial in Defense Exhibit I. It does include a statement of Neff's sentence, but my point was, after Senior Airman Roach's trial was over, the CA granted additional relief to Airman First Class Neff. And that information is not in the record of trial. That information is in the motion to attach documents that we filed on September 18, 2007. So the CCA, when it performed its sentence appropriateness review, was unaware of this fact. a lawyer would have brought this fact to the CCA's attention, and that's why appellate representation is important, because appellate counsel bring things to the case that the court cannot.
When that motion was made, it was not made at the time that the issue of prejudice that's now under consideration was before the court. If the court were to reconsider and grant that motion, is there any reason why the court then couldn't consider it with respect to the issue of prejudice? I understand why you don't want prejudice argued, but if we decide prejudice, why can't we consider it at that point?
But this court could consider that issue on that document on the issue of prejudice, not through the question of whether Senior M. and Roach deserve sentence relief under sentence appropriateness theory. But because that's not this court doesn't have authority to answer this question. But this court could consider that for consideration of whether Senior M. and Roach was prejudiced by his denial of his right to counsel under the Sixth Amendment, Article 70, and Rule for Court Martial 1202, when the lower court made its sentence appropriateness determination, Your Honor.
Got it. You may very briefly conclude.
Your Honor, I'll conclude by reading a portion of the government's brief.
If you could just refer to it, I believe that would be sufficient, unless any of my colleagues want to have it all read to us at this point.
Yes, Your Honor, but it's important because what the government wrote in its brief is so drastically in conflict with what it said today.
If you'd like to refer to the specific page, we'll be glad to take a look at it.
Thank you, Your Honor. On page 19, when the government said that the delay in this case was due to the appellate defense counsel's caseload, and when the government said that the appellate defense counsel did not read the record in this trial, the government was right then. Senior Airman Roach's rights were violated by the proceedings before the lower court, and a service member should not have his conviction and sentence affirmed where he has never even had an appellate defense counsel working for him read the record of trial. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Appreciate your argument. Does the government want to use any of the extra 2 minutes that we provided to the defense at this point for anything further? Thank you, counsel. The case is now submitted. We appreciate the presentation of all counsel and the extra time that was provided today. The case will be taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess until 10 minutes after 10.
Court stands in recess until 10:10.